Well, hello there, and welcome to Food Lab Talk. I'm your host, Michael Bakker. Today's guest believes that the key to shifting habits is to change our personal food environment to make the healthy choice the easy choice. Jack Bobo is the director of the University of Nottingham's Food Systems Institute, which brings together transdisciplinary researchers to address some of the most pressing food systems challenges. With a background in international law, food and environmental policy, and behavioral science, Jack leads the Institute in rethinking how food is farmed, processed, transported, and consumed, and develop new technological and economic models that drive positive change. Prior to joining the Institute, Jack served as the Director of Global Food and Water Policy at the Nature Conservancy. He's also the author of the 2021 book, Why Smart People Make Bad Food Choices. A truly global change maker. Welcome to the show, Jack. Happy to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's going to be a fun conversation, Jack. To get things started, tell us a little bit more about the Institute and its aims.
Yeah, a lot of people ask me, why Nottingham? Why the UK? Because I was leaving the Nature Conservancy, which is the world's largest conservation organization, and it's an amazing place to work. But one of the things that they didn't do is they don't go all the way to the consumer. And so much of the change that we need to make requires us to change also what consumers are doing so that they send signals throughout the supply chain. And so one of the amazing things about a university like the University of Nottingham is that it touches the entire food system. It goes from genomics to plant science to food processing to food science to consumer psychology to food supply change to forced labor in the supply chain. And so, it really doesn't matter where your interests are, they are doing something in that area. And so I'm just really delighted to be able to be in a place where I can have that kind of an impact. And so this institute, it's a brand new institute, and it's trying to do two things. I mean, one is just engage in thought leadership and engage around the world in these important conversations to be able to share the research that's coming out of the university. But I think the most important piece is that my job is to connect the research across the university so that we can scale the impact of the work we already do. Too often, universities, just like governments and organizations, are siloed in the work they do. And if you can find a way across those silos, you can actually have a bigger impact with the things that you're already doing. And so that's what I'm really hoping to be able to deliver at the university.
Wow. And am I correct that it's, as of today, the only UK university offering research expertise and capabilities across the broader food system?
Well, there's certainly a number of universities that engage in food system research sort of narrowly, but it's one of the few that really does all of those pieces and does them all really well. It's one of the best universities in the world. It's one of the top research universities in the UK. And we have campuses in China and Malaysia, and we're doing research across sub-Saharan Africa, looking at micronutrient deficiencies and how farmers uptake new technologies. And so the breadth and depth of the university is quite remarkable.
I did not know that. So you've been around the block, worn many different hats in your career. So what is it that led you to actually lead this institute and to move to the UK?
Well, for me, it's how do we have change on a global scale? Because it doesn't matter what you're doing in your backyard. It doesn't matter what you're doing in the next farm or field over. It's all connected. And it's really hard to find a place that's sort of open to taking such a broad perspective. And I have to say, it's probably because I was coming to this new that they're willing to sort of take a chance on somebody who, by most accounts, is sort of a policy wonk to lead a global research institute. But I do think that it was that outward facing nature that, they were sort of looking for an ambassador for the research and not somebody who was sort of deep in one area, but somebody who was broad. And so it was just a really good fit. And so I spend probably 50% of my time traveling around the world and around the UK in order to talk to different audiences about these important questions. For example, just earlier today, I was at an event organized by Nature looking at sodium reduction. And you know, we're looking at how do you do that from a policy perspective? How do you do that from a consumer perspective? How do you get industry interested in making these kinds of changes? And so they're all complicated, interconnected questions. And that systems approach, I think, is the only way we're going to reach resolution with any of them.
Got it. Jack, before we focus on enabling choice, love to talk to you a little bit more about the bigger picture for a moment. Food systems as a whole. Based on your experience, what elements do you believe are truly critical for a sustainable food system?
You know, it's a big question. And I mean, you know the numbers better than I do. You know, 40% of all the land on Earth is devoted to agriculture. 70% of fresh water goes to agriculture. A third of greenhouse gas emissions either come directly from agriculture or deforestation. Biodiversity loss is driven by agriculture. And so the question of the sustainability of agriculture is really important. But we also have 800 million people who will go to bed hungry tonight. And so it's not enough that we just reduce the environmental impact of agriculture, but we need to improve the nutritional outcomes of a billion people. And that doesn't even get to the billion people who are suffering with obesity or overweight. So those are big challenges. And I think that part of what we have to do is find a way to bring people together to solve these problems. And I have some sort of concrete examples we can get to. But for me, if you can't agree on the problem, you're going to be polarized. And if you're polarized, you're pulling in different directions. And if you're doing that, it's very hard for governments to invest in a solution because it's easier to do nothing if you're a government than to offend one part of the electorate over another.
So what I'm always surprised by is the following. It feels to me that we have a pretty good understanding of the challenges we're dealing with in the food system. You just articulated those. And so much research has been done over the years as well to come up with potential solutions. So it feels to me we have solutions as well. Why do you believe it's so hard for us to act upon the solutions that we have identified through research? So what is holding us back?
One of the things that's holding us back is the language we use. I hear over and over again that our food system is broken. And obviously, when I talk about the impacts agriculture is having on the environment, that sounds like a broken food system. When I talk about 800 million people going to bed hungry, that sounds like a broken food system. But, you know, it also raises the question, when was the food system not broken? You know, if you go back 30 years, 20% of all the people on the planet were going to bed hungry. If you go back 60 years, 30% of all the people on the planet were going to bed hungry. Without innovation, and just as an example, if we were farming today the way we did in 1960s with 1960s technology, we would need 1 billion additional hectares of land to produce the food we do. And so while agriculture is the single biggest driver of deforestation, it's also the single biggest protector of forests. And those two things can be true at the same time. And if we don't understand that, then we are not going to be able to bring the food system and the farmers and others into this conversation. Because we often talk about the problem, the impact they're having, but we need to recognize that in many ways, things are not bad and getting worse. They're good and getting better, but not fast enough. And how you frame the conversation determines if people work with you or work against you.
So assume for a moment that it's true what you just said, Jack. Just build upon that. So how do we change the language? What is getting in the way there?
Well, you know, I came from a conservation organization, and conservation organizations are really good at telling farmers what they should do. But I don't know anybody who likes to be told what to do. I have two kids. They're in college. If I want them to do something, I tell them to do the opposite. And then I have sort of a decent chance that they might actually do it. And so if we instead stop talking about what they should do and we started talking about what they could do, well, could is about opportunity. Could is about doing better. And so just a change in language could have a profound impact on how people perceive it. And, you know, if we did nothing, agriculture would be wildly better in 2050 than it is today, just because farmers and scientists and food companies are still trying to make it better every day. So the problem isn't, you know, how do we fix agriculture? It's how do we get to our 2070 goals by 2050? How do we get to our 2050 goals by 2030? How do we accelerate the pace of improvement? And that's exciting. And that will bring people from that farming community together. Let me give you just one other sort of example that I've been using in a lot of talks recently. I've been talking to a lot of people in the beef and dairy sector. I was in Canada last week talking to the Alberta beef people. I was speaking at the National Farmers Union here in the UK. And one of the things I've been asking beef producers is, we need 25% more food by 2050 to meet a growing need. Would you rather achieve that because livestock expands? So this is the livestock win scenario. Or would you rather achieve that because alternative proteins expand to meet that need? Well, it's probably not a surprise. They all raised their hand on the first one. They said, we want livestock to win. And I said, but let's imagine what happens if they do. If we add 2 billion more animals to the planet to meet that need, we need to cut down a huge amount of the forest in order to deliver it. And if demand increases and supply increases, your income is flat. But we have huge environmental impacts and people hate you. On the other hand, if alternative proteins expand to meet that future need, well, we don't cut down the forest. Demand outpaces supply and you're making 2 or 3 times more money and you're viewed as a premium product. So the future people think that is good for them sometimes isn't. And once you sort of articulate that, then people can say, huh, maybe I shouldn't be trying to block those new technologies from coming to market because maybe that's actually an opportunity for myself. And instead, they've been actually defending deforestation instead of defending these alternative protein companies. And I don't think they're ever going to be best friends, but perhaps they can view the relationship differently.
Totally hear you. So we're talking about the complexity of food systems. What is your underlying theory of change over here? So is your belief that better holistic research will lead to different outcomes? That's how you believe change is going to happen, Jack?
Yeah, I think that I believe less in right and wrong and good and bad, and more in thinking in terms of choices and consequences. And if you can help to lay out the consequences of actions, I think in many ways you can lead people to knowledge instead of sort of beating them up with science. Again, researchers and academicians, they love to tell people what to do and they like to tell them the answer. And I think it's much better to be able to help people to understand the consequences of different choices. And then you may end up getting a different outcome. But if they go ahead with that, at least they understand the consequences of it. And it's a, you know, it's an informed decision. And I can give you an example of that where we're struggling here in the UK. In Wales, the government has called for 10% of all agricultural land to be planted with trees. And you can imagine how happy the farmers are to, you know, take their fields and have to turn it into forest. So they've been pushing back on the government saying this is going to undermine our income. It's going to undermine food security here in the UK. And those things are probably true. But the government's doing it because they're trying to reduce their environmental impact in terms of emissions. And so the engagement that I've had is to say, well, the conversation you should be having with the government is to say, well, if we do this, we will produce less food. And if we produce less food, we will import more food. So what's the impact of that imported food? Is it raising global emissions or is it reducing global emissions? I don't know the answer to that question, but if they don't know the answer, maybe they shouldn't be imposing a policy that could increase global emissions. And so now you have this really interesting conversation, and you're doing it in terms that matter to those that are putting into place the policy. And so you're like talking about apples and apples instead of apples and oranges.
Love that approach, Jack. I'll actually shift gears a little and talk a little more about your book, as well as from how might we enable individuals to make informed, personally relevant food choices, and then tying it to your work. So in preparing for this interview, I came across a TEDx talk you did in 2019 called Why We Fear the Food We Eat. And in it, you talked about cognitive bias and availability heuristics. And for the audience, we'll link the video in the show notes. But I'd love to hear how, in your experience, behavioral psychology impacts our perceptions and influences our choices related to food.
Well, and you know, that's really what got me started on the book, is trying to understand how do people sort of come to believe what they believe and know what they know, and when do people change their minds? And you know, you didn't mention it, but you know, I spent 13 years at the US Department of State working on global food policy. And while I was there, I sort of realized that science at the beginning of a conversation actually just polarized the audience. Those who agreed with you agreed more, but those who disagreed actually became more vehemently opposed. And so I went back to sort of my psychology roots and started reading about psychology and marketing and advertising. And I realized that you really need to find a way of building trust. And so one of the ways that I try to build trust with audiences is when I talk about something like confirmation bias. You know, we're all really good at identifying bias in other people. You know, our friends and family are mostly idiots and, you know, they're wrong and they're biased all the time. But, you know, it's very hard to see bias in ourselves. And I think that it's helpful for us to be able to sort of take the time to try to understand our own biases because it helps us to engage with others. So I often tell sort of an example of my own bias. And, you know, if I were to read an article that said organic produce is more nutritious than conventional, you know, I'd probably ask, who are the authors? Who funded that research? And what was their methodology? And I think those are pretty reasonable things to do. But what if the article said organic, no more nutritious than conventional? What would I do? I'd tweet it or X it. I don't know what we do anymore. But the point is, I'd push it out to the world. And that's really what bias is. I mean, we ask the tough questions of things we disagree, and we give a pass to the things that we agree with. And I think that, you know, we really need to be willing to sort of dissect our own beliefs. And if we do, we're going to be in a much better position to engage with others. And then, you know, you mentioned the availability heuristic, which is just sort of a complicated way of saying what things come to mind when I say a word. Again, our brains are leading us astray all the time. Hopefully, if listeners leave this podcast with one thing, it's that they should not trust their brain because it's just not very trustworthy. And, you know, the example with the availability heuristic is like, when I say the word natural, you know, what things come to mind? Are you thinking rainbows and butterflies and puppies, or are you thinking salmonella, E. coli, and listeria? Because those things are all natural as well. But our minds just go to a happy place. And, you know, somebody puts a label on a package that says natural, we're like, ooh, that sounds great. And, you know, again, the more we understand how our brain is misleading us, the better we're going to be able to make better choices ourselves, but also just have better conversations with others. And so that's sort of the first third of the book is trying to help us sort of dissect when we should and shouldn't trust our brain.
All right, you said it. I cannot trust my brain. So will information or education help me or not?
Unfortunately, the research doesn't give us hope there. You know, I think that when you look at things like the dietary guidelines and others, most people don't use that information. And those who do are the people that were probably eating most healthy anyway. And, you know, when you think about menu labeling, you know, when I was a student, I'd go into McDonald's and I would say, well, what has the most calories per dollar here? And so, you know, I was probably doing exactly the opposite of what they wanted to use information for. And I think that, you know, this is part of the challenge with how we approach things like nutrition and health today. And it's part of what led me to the book is that in many ways, we've never known more about health and nutrition in the history of the planet, and we've never been more obese. We've never had more healthy food options in a grocery store, and we've never been more obese. We've never had better labeling on products. And so like all of the things that you would really expect to improve nutritional outcomes have totally failed us. And that's sort of what I wanted to grapple with sort of that second part of the book was, how did we get here?
Yeah. So I have to ask you the follow-up question. So I cannot trust my brain. Can I trust my friends? Because I think one interesting concept in your book is that we make food choices based on what others around us are eating. To me, it's like a positive thing. I see what my friends are doing, they're making a good food choice. So I'm going to be better off as well. Is that true? Or shouldn't I trust my friends either?
Well, you know, it depends on who your friends are, probably, but it is tough because, you know, we all live in more or less the same food environment. And so we're all subject to some of those same pressures. So, you know, your friends could lead you to better choices. They could lead you astray. And I think there's too much pressure on the individual right now to be able to figure all of this out. And especially with billions spent on diet treatments and things like that. I mean, if they were going to work, they would have worked. And, you know, if they did, people would know about it. And so I think it's a much more complicated challenge, you know, than just sort of figuring out the answer for ourselves.
Yeah. And I think your book suggests as well that our choices are often driven by invisible influences. Could you give some examples of those influences? And then my follow-up question is going to be, now that you know them, obviously they're invisible, but what can you do to overcome them?
Yeah, I mean, one of those influences is just value. You know, when somebody offers us a lot more food for just a little bit of money, that is so powerful. And I don't want to throw them under the bus. I mean, people come back to restaurants because they give them large portions. And restaurants give you large portions because the cost driver of a restaurant is labor and real estate. It's not the food itself. So here's the trick, though, is that if you eat two meals for the price of one, that is terrible value. If you get two meals for the price of one and you can take one of them home, that is fantastic value. So how do we shift the culture and the mindset so that we're actually able to benefit from the largesse that restaurants are offering us instead of it leading us to be less happy and less healthy and less wealthy?
I love that explanation. So one of the things I focus on, Jack, is how do people make personally relevant food choices? Based on your experience, any thoughts on ultimately how a person can make personally relevant food choices based on the context you described so far?
Yeah, so there are things you can do. One thing you can't do is you can't just put half of your plate aside and eat half your meal and take half of it home. The problem is your brain thinks you didn't finish your meal, and so you're actually hungry 2 hours later. If you're going to do that, you actually want to box up half your meal before you take the first bite, you know, because then you finish your plate. Another thing, you know, my family and I have done for years and years is that, you know, I have two kids, so we go to a restaurant and we only order three meals. So I have not ordered any food in years. The designated scrap eater, you know, and we'll often get dessert, but not a single time in 5 years have we ever finished all the food and thought, wow, I really wish we had ordered another meal. Inevitably, there's actually still food left over when you're just ordering three for four people. And so part of it is just figuring out strategies that work for you that, you know, work within your lifestyle, but also, you know, recognizing how our brain can mislead us. And it's not about limiting pleasure. It's about maximizing enjoyment. And just as an example of that, you know, imagine the last time you're on an airplane and somebody gave you that little 6 or 7 ounce soda. And if you drank it, you probably thought, wow, you know, that's the best soda I've had in years. And the reason is that you finish drinking it and you're still at the bliss point. Whereas if you drink a liter soda, by the time you get to that last 6 or 7 or 8 ounces, you're just not really enjoying it anymore. And so how do we maximize our enjoyment of the food that we eat and stress about it a whole lot less?
But going back to everything is so interdependent these days, it's in the interest of a restaurant to sell you four more ounces because it leads to $2 additional in revenues. So how do you see that systems change? Is that government policy? Is that a consumer campaign? Is it you hoping that consumers are going to stand up? How do you change what has now become so ingrained for sure in the American food system?
Yeah, I think it's a little of all of the above. I think government policy could absolutely help people to know when the meal that they're being served has three times the daily allowance of calories. You know, I think somebody should realize that before they take the first bite. But, you know, also I think that there are ways of, you know, changing social norms. You know, other ideas in terms of like, how do we create social campaigns? You may have heard of this idea or this slogan, "Don't mess with Texas." Many of us have, at least in the United States. And most of us don't remember or realize that it actually started as an anti-littering campaign back in the 80s. And, you know, the state couldn't figure out how to stop people from throwing trash out the window in highways. They tried all sorts of different things. And then they thought of this campaign because the research they had done suggested that the people that were littering the most were sort of young men. Big surprise. So the idea for this campaign was to actually plug in to that sense of pride that many people in Texas feel. And all of a sudden, it's like the same people that were littering were like, why did you throw that out the window? It's like, you're insulting, you know, my home. And so they captured that sentiment and that feeling. You know, I have less sort of belief that, you know, older folks like myself are going to change our behavior. But I do think that you could engage with younger people and help them to understand, you know, why should you go for quality instead of going for that value? How do we think in terms of, you know, maximizing my enjoyment instead of maximizing the size of that brownie? And, you know, how do we get people excited about things like vegetables? You know, when I cook with my kids when they were growing up. And now I was talking to my son just a couple of weeks ago, and he said, whenever I go to this friend's house, you know, they just don't serve vegetables. And I'm craving it by the time I leave. And I was like, yes, my work is done. So they can be indoctrinated.
Lasting legacy. So Jack, as you probably know, the biggest audience of the show are change makers working in food systems. What advice might you have for change leaders, specifically affecting change in a complex system like food?
I think the most important thing comes down to communication. The language we use determines if people work with us or work against us. And too often, the language we're using is polarizing the audience. And so those who are working hard to make a difference can inadvertently make things worse. And just as an example, I often talk to companies in the alternative protein space. And one of the things I always tell them is that most of the people they're trying to reach are meat eaters. You know, they're not trying to convert the vegetarians and vegans. And so I tell them that most people won't eat their product because they believe what they believe. They will eat it in spite of it. And so they need to get their beliefs out of the way and let the product speak for itself. And I'll give you an example how this has worked in practice. Back in, I think, 2017, I gave a talk. I told the cultivated meat world, which is the lab-grown meat, that they needed to kill the term they were using at the time, clean meat. And, you know, I argued that it was denigrating the livestock sector and that ultimately, you know, you're suggesting that your consumer is evil if they don't eat your product. And so that's just not a great positioning. And so then I spent 10 months working with different companies in that sector. And by September of 2018, they had all agreed that they would no longer use that term. And so the reason we use cultivated meat today was a very intentional effort on the part of that industry to stop denigrating part of the food system so that they would create the space for better understanding. And so I would just encourage everybody to think about the language they use and how they can use language that brings people together and does not further divide us.
Got it. I think it's easy to focus as well on the successes we've had in our careers, but sometimes we might have learned more from the things that didn't go quite as we planned. So if you knew then what you know now, what might you have done differently on your change-making career?
Well, the first thing that I learned is that networking is a life skill, and it's not a job search skill. And I originally come from Indiana, where we thought networking was evil. It's not who you know that should matter, it's what you know. And so I sort of came to it as a reluctant networker. But once I realized it's a life skill, it's how you're treating people, and you know, you're helping people with no expectation of getting something in return, and yet you know that those people want to help you because you've helped them. That was, you know, really important to change, and you know, how I engage with other people and sort of built my network. The other thing is really understanding how people come to learn information. Like, how do you lead people to knowledge instead of beating them up with science? You know, I had to give the same presentation 500 times before it got decent. And not everybody gets to do that. You know, every time I gave it, I took out one less chart or added one more picture or one more story. And so, you know, I really encourage everybody to think about how do they communicate in a way that brings people in and resonates with them, the emotion, the empathy. So that communication style, in addition to the communication itself, were lessons that I had to learn the hard way, and it absolutely wasn't necessary, but I wasn't that sharp.
Got it. And then maybe last but least in this section, Jack, food systems can be incredibly complex, and change often happens very unpredictably, sometimes for the better, sometimes from the worse. Have you experienced that? And if so, could you share an example with us?
Yeah, you know, I think when we think about systems and sustainability, I mentioned sort of that idea of sort of good and bad earlier. And what I found, and I came to this slowly, was that when we talk about maybe organic or agroecology, you know, that's a lighter impact. And, you know, I used to think, well, but it's less sustainable because you need land somewhere else. And we really need to be producing more on the land we have. And that's more of an intensive system. And now I think I've realized that the lower impact agriculture, well, the benefits are local because you have less nutrient runoff and other things, but you don't produce as much. So the impacts are global. Whereas with intensive agriculture, the impacts are local because you might have soil compaction and nutrient runoff and other things, but the benefits are global and spread out. And really, it's just a continuum from this local sustainability to the global sustainability. And there will always be trade-offs between those two things. And they both contribute to our food system in different ways. You know, it took me a while to sort of wrap my mind around that. But in the end, you know, there are places where we need to take a softer, lighter touch, and there are places where we can afford to be more intensive. Once you realize that, you realize we're all working on the same problem. We're just working on different aspects of it.
Thank you for sharing that. And Jack, thank you so much for your time today to hear more about your work and what you're doing, actually learning more about the Institute as well. So thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
It was so much fun chatting with Jack today, and I always learn from him, and he has these amazing one-liners. But reflecting on today's interview, here are my top three takeaways for change makers. Foster collaboration to break down silos and amplify collective impact. While solutions may exist, differences in language, siloing of organizations or departments, and polarization often get in the way of progress. One way Jack addressed this in his own work was to design the system differently. His institute doesn't sit within a specific school. It spans all departments, bringing people together, encouraging knowledge sharing, and fostering collaboration to truly accelerate the pace of change. Navigate trade-offs by reframing your thinking. In a complex system, you will inevitably encounter trade-offs. Rather than thinking of a potential outcome as good or bad, consider them as choices with associated consequences. In Jack's experience, this approach encourages openness to new information, avoiding the pitfall he calls beating them up with science and deepening their understanding of the potential impact. Language matters. How we communicate can either bring people together or it can divide. Instead of dictating what people should do, guide them to explore what they could do. The word could implies opportunity and improvement. A simple change in language can have a profound impact on how people perceive your message, opening doors to reach new audiences and to drive change. For more information about the University of Nottingham's Food System Institute and other topics from today's episode, be sure to check out the show notes. And thank you for joining us for this episode. If you liked what you've heard, subscribe to the podcast at foodlabtalk.com or wherever you listen to your podcast. And be sure to follow us on LinkedIn and YouTube at foodlabtalk. As we close, I invite you to pursue your own bold vision and take whatever action you can take toward a better food system. Imagine, believe, and most importantly, act. See you next time.